RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Who and what is Panda? Panda was established in April 2020 by a group of multidisciplinary professionals who perceived the global reaction to COVID from lockdowns to mandates as overwrought and damaging to the point of causing a great tear in the fabric of society. You might have heard Panda mentioned, in fact, featured on this radio station in our Inquiry Sessions series with Alastair Harding, because one of Alastair's guests in that series was Nick Hudson, the chairman of Panda, who joins us beaming in all the way from Cape Town, South Africa. Nick, welcome to our program this time. It's nice to have you.
No, very good to be here, and hello to your listeners.
Tell us a bit more about Panda first, for those who might not have heard the previous Inquiry Session program.
Right. Well, I mean, Panda was set up in South Africa right in the early months of 2020 in response to a realization amongst a number of people in my network that the whole story of COVID presenting an unusual threat was looking false. The actual initial data that emerged didn't point towards anything unusual, and also a sense that nobody was doing a cost-benefit analysis on lockdowns, that we were proceeding down a path that would almost certainly cause more harm than deliver benefits. And what was initially a loose affiliation, simply trying to make the case to our politicians and public health professionals that lockdown was a very bad idea and that we shouldn't do one, grew into first an important voice in South Africa, and then later an important voice internationally. We attracted lots of scientists and social philosophers and so on, business people, data scientists, lawyers, economists, you name it, into the organization, because people all over the world found themselves in this position where their own institutions were pre-committed to the panoply of COVID policy response, and that they found that there was a lot of internal censorship, external censorship, media censorship that prevented them from being able to articulate their views against the COVID policy response.
Right. That was a very common experience right around the world. Still trying to work that one out. Got any ideas?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, there was a famous trial run for a coronavirus outbreak, by absolute coincidence, of course, that was held in the closing months of 2019, called Event 201. And it's very interesting, if you go through the archival footage of that event, you'll see that the topic they're most concerned about is how they're going to censor people who object to the policy measures. So a lot of people say, oh, you know, the entire COVID phenomenon was a hoax, and that it was simulated before the event. They practiced, they worked out how they were going to drive fear and hysteria into the communities. And there's a lot of truth in that. But the thing that was most pre-planned was the silencing of dissenting voices, the censorship. It led to me to develop a little rubric for detecting scams. I like to say that if a problem is held to be a global crisis, admitting only global solutions and amid the suppression of dissent, then that problem is a hoax.
They knew they had to move on that. So they knew what they were. Can I use the word they? That they had.
You can
coming.
Use the word they. I mean, you know, I think there are plenty of emergent characteristics in this whole phenomenon, so that the people responsible is a ever evolving collective with fairly diverse intentions and incentives. So I'm very happy with you using the word they.
Yeah, I wish I knew who the top they was. You know, the actual. Number one, they.
You know, humans really like to tell stories, and the stories always have, you know, characters, actors, protagonists, and protagonists. when those stories, that when the actual stories of reality are more complex, they sort of clash with our predilection for stories. But I have become comfortable with the idea that there is an element of planning and in conspiracy in the driving of the whole COVID narrative, but that there's also a very strong element of emergence. So bad ideas that accumulate over time and find adherence in diverse organizations do so for diverse reasons. One organization who's propelling the narrative might be doing so for pecuniary reasons, another one for reasons of status, another one because of political objectives for control, another one because they sell more newspapers if they talk about catastrophe. So there are lots of different motives that align and can cause events to grip us, when in reality the underlying substance of those events is really that of a nothing burger.
Is that like a perfect storm of bad actors?
I think so. There was an element like that. People who are even vaguely informed about the history of pandemics know that there are certainly a great deal more pandemic hoaxes than there are pandemics. That in 2009, the World Health Organization was directly implicated in an attempt to spawn a pandemic out of nothing, working with an alleged H1N1 outbreak that had its supposed epicenter in Mexico. And this was widely covered. You know, this is not the material of crazy conspiracy theory loons working in their basements. This was covered extensively in Western media, an issue that was addressed in the European Parliament, the doctors and epidemiologists who exposed the World Health Organization's scam were congratulated and recognized. So there's a long history of scam pandemics. And many people, including myself, actually doubt whether any real pandemic is an actual plausible phenomenon. I think that it is not, that this whole pandemic narrative is a load of nonsense.
So there wasn't a coronavirus called COVID-19?
Well, there was a virus, I would say, with a reasonably high level of certainty, or rather I should say there was a collection of viruses. A couple of qualifications on that, though, qualifiers on that. COVID-19 is not a virus. COVID-19 is a disease purported to arise in some people infected by the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
Okay. Yeah.
Whether the SARS-CoV-2 virus is unique and whether it has pandemic potential, those are two different questions. And I think the answer to both of those questions is no.
Can we quantify with any sort of accuracy now, and you're an actuary, so you're probably a very good person to ask this question of, the cost? Let's look at lockdowns, the actual cost of it across the board. How much of a terrible impact was made by lockdowns? Do we know?
Look, it's a very difficult thing to assess, and I will get to some estimates. But the important thing to recognize is that there are two important economic stories going on when it comes to assessing the impact of lockdowns. The first one is, what is the direct cost in terms of lost production of goods and services as a result of the economic consequences of closures and essential worker permissions and all of that, Huey, that we went through in 2020 and 2021. And the second one is how much wealth transfer there was. When you were forced to buy 100 masks or whatever it was in Germany, those 100 masks diverted your consumption away from the things you'd prefer to spend money on and into the hands of the essentially criminal network who pandered those useless interventions. And estimates of the global wealth transfer directly consequent to the pandemic projection and policy response come in at around $4 trillion. It's the greatest single wealth transfer event in human history.
That is a kind of motive, isn't it?
Totally. I think the two biggest motives for me are the age-old motive for control over other human beings. That's something that history tells us is a motive that is with us since the mists of time. And the second one, I would say, is the economic motive. The BioNTech, the company that is behind the Pfizer vaccines. Pfizer is just a marketing organization, and people are often misled into believing that Pfizer is the entity they should be focusing on when it's really BioNTech, a German company. But companies like BioNTech have made an absolute fortune in a fashion that could only be mandated by governments and propelled in by a massive conflagration of egos, falsehoods, and greed.
Is there anything in the German connection then? Just mentioned that company from Germany. I don't know if this is a very sensitive question. Was that a very German thing to invent and make?
Look, the German involvement is in the whole hoax is one of the least reported aspects of the story of the scam. The hoax centers around, I think, three primary entities: the Robert Koch Institute, which is Germany's equivalent of the CDC. It's a slight stretch of the truth to make that statement, but it's their closest approximation, should we say, to the US CDC. In particular, a guy by the name of Dr. Christian Drosten, who was sort of Germany's Anthony Fauci, and who was highly involved, very intensely involved in the development of the all too important PCR testing protocols.
Here we go.
I've done a deep dive on the evolution of those protocols. Well, should we say Panda has done that deep dive, and their involvement is almost comical. You know, they pump out the papers supporting the methods in such an implausibly compressed time frame that any half commercial person looking at that time frame concludes immediately that the whole thing was A, pre-planned, and B, complete bullshit.
So who made the money out of that product then? Was it that German company, or was it shared around?
Look, I mean, there are plenty of billionaires who've been created by the COVID phenomenon, because it's not just the PCR tests that made people wealthy. A lot of people in the testing and pathology area found that they were selling lateral flow tests, and then there's the pharmaceutical companies selling remdesivir and Paxlovid, and there are people selling all the PPE, which, you know, even if the theories of virology are true, all of that PPE was entirely useless. The Perspex shields, the cloth masks, the face visors, the stickers on the floor, the public broadcasting facilities telling you to stand more than 6 feet apart, and all that kind of story was completely bananas. There was absolutely no rationale to any of that. There's no foundation in pre-COVID science or, you know, pandemic guidelines. So there were an awful lot of people making a lot of money. But yes, BioNTech is one of them. And it's 50% owned by the German government. So it's really the German government that ultimately, you know, all roads lead to Rome, as it were. But my sense is that one of the least reported stories of the COVID scam is how much involvement by the German government there was. But I would also say that I do not consider it to be, for the COVID phenomenon to be a primarily German phenomenon. It's that Germany has an important role, but I think the intelligence community in particular of the Five Eyes nations had played an important role. The U.S. Department of Defense, the CDC, the FDA in the U.S., and of course, the World Health Organization, they were all in on the scam.
We are Five Eyes here. You probably know that.
Of course. Yeah. And it's not surprising that the Antipodean nations, Australia and New Zealand, had these incredibly draconian and hysterical reactions with widespread vaccine uptake and a lot of force used in the vaccine mandate rollout, or at least the vaccine rollout.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's a coincidence. The same can be said for Canada. Germany, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and parts of the United States were among the very most bedwetting nations in the whole story.
Well put. Do you think, I want to get on to future pandemics in just a moment, but do you think, I mean, that's an interesting grouping of countries. There are plenty more other countries in the world to choose from if you want to, you know, go big scale. But that group of countries, why that group, do you think? I know there's Five Eyes and everything, but there's a similarity in cultures, right?
Yep.
Western culture. And I guess behavioral patterns, so you can kind of guesstimate, you know, the reaction across multiple countries. Is there anything in this grouping of countries?
First of all, qualitatively, those are your nanny states, the ones where the populations are more likely to accept the idea that government is there to be good to you. There's also very high penetration in those countries of social media. Usage rates of social media are very high. They also have in common that they have quite large, let's call them parasitic classes. So lots of highly educated, or should I say highly university attending people, spreadsheet jockeys, bureaucrats, office jockeys, people who are highly compliant and more likely to follow authority. That's just the product of a long history of prosperity. We tend towards the promotion of linear thinkers over nonlinear ones in countries that have been stable and developed and economically successful for the longest period of time. I can contrast it to South Africa. In South Africa, and South Africa forms a very interesting test case because we have this phenomenon of a very wealthy white minority as a sort of a hangover of the apartheid and colonial years, and a significantly less wealthy black majority. Vaccine take-up rates amongst that wealthy, parasitic class-dominated white minority were extremely high, whereas by and large the black majority, who had recently had real and pertinent experience of the extent to which governments can work against the people, roundly rejected the vaccines. They were take-up rates were incredibly low. And in a very interesting sort of quasi-anecdotal observation, but it's now sort of one of those things that you sort of have noticed too often to ignore, it was the black urban professionals who had the highest rates of uptake, and your laborers and rural people who were most likely to smell a rat.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because you'd think the smart people would be the ones who, you know, that an alarm goes off. And they'd take it. So, all right, then. I keep hearing about future pandemics, being prepared for future pandemics. I hear it quite a bit, as if these things come along all the time. But, you know, if you look at the data, they're quite rare, and they usually burn out. And, you know, the Spanish flu was post-bacterial infections, et cetera, wiping people out, not necessarily the actual virus. Kind of get the feeling that we're being primed up for more of this. Is that your feeling?
I think there's a strong desire in certain quarters to make pandemics an almost permanent state of affairs. I don't think there is such a phenomenon as a viral pandemic. Yeah, it's interesting that you highlight the 1917-18 Spanish flu, because obviously all of the entire story of the Spanish flu arose many, many years, decades before the real development of virology and epidemiology, really. And it's a very contentious point. People forget that this was the end of the most brutal conflict that the planet had yet seen, the First World War. Many, many young men, amongst whom the damage was the most concentrated, had poor nutrition for many years, exposure to incredible environmental stresses on the battlefronts, including, you know, noxious poison gases that were used as weapons during the conflict on the front. And I think that the idea that the whole dying off phenomenon of the Spanish flu was attributable to a virus is at this stage, it's a laughable proposition. We can see many other factors, as you correctly point to, bacterial pneumonia, I've mentioned also the lung damage caused by exposure to gases, but there was also a bad iatrogenic component to it. So iatrogenicity refers to the principle of harm sometimes being caused by treatments. So treatments in hospitals, treatments at the hands of public health officials, etc. And in this case, it involved overprescription of aspirin. It was thought that aspirin was the wonder drug that would treat the Spanish flu. And overprescription of aspirin is compatible with a lot of the accounts of the severe cases and deaths that are available from that time period.
Okay, so the next pandemic comes along.
Yeah.
Can you see any modification, assuming the same kind of methods and techniques are deployed? Obviously, there'll have to be tweaks, right, to get around the learnings or to overcome the learnings of what we've experienced just in the last 3 years. How do you see a scenario like that playing out in a post-COVID experience? Will lockdowns be tried again? Is anyone going to stake a claim to a lockdown and explain why, you know, the economy's smashed to pieces? You know, all the gear again, masks, PPE. What sort of form do you see it taking if it comes upon us again?
Okay, let me make a few observations and then indulge in a bit of guesswork. The first observation I would make is that we can do no better than to consult the World Health Organization Pandemic Accord and its subsidiary document, the International Health Regulations, which are currently undergoing a process of attempted amendment. And if we look at the provisions of those documents, I think they paint the picture quite well of what powers the authorities, global health authorities, would like to have bestowed upon them. The first thing to observe is they want to almost do away with the need for there to be an actual pandemic when they declare one. So in terms of the provisions that have been proposed, it is down to one person with no requirement on that person to consult with anybody whatsoever to declare a pandemic. And that one person, the Secretary General of the World Health Organization, is allowed to declare a pandemic on the suspicion that the conditions exist in which a pandemic might arise. So he just has to say, look, we've identified a pathogen in Mongolia that has pandemic potential. Or he might even dispense with that and say something completely absurd like global warming increases pandemic potential. We think that the chances of an outbreak has gone up for 2025. So we are now rolling out a plethora of global policy responses, and your country needs to implement them under peril of losing access to financing facilities under the Bretton Woods organizations. I think that's kind of what the picture looks like. What else can we tell from those stories? Well, they certainly haven't learned the lesson that lockdowns don't work. They certainly haven't learned the lessons that vaccine mandates are contrary to all manner of ethical codes and moral constructs, but also that they're wholly ineffective. So they want to proceed down paths that highly resemble the COVID policy response, despite the fact that it has very little empirical evidence of effectiveness. We can get onto that later if you wish. So their intentions are clear. But I think there's also a phenomenon in the real world of people who realize that the whole story was a con, that their lives were greatly worsened by the policy response. There are a lot of people who realize that the best thing to have done would have been nothing, to proceed as usual, and that if we had done that, we would have noticed nothing unusual in our death rates or our morbidity rates. And I think they know that that's the case. So what do we find? Well, after an attempt at ginning up fear around a pandemic of monkeypox, which failed completely, people were having none of it. They weren't going to be fooled by the recycling of the same 1951 photograph purporting to show a monkeypox case when it was actually a purported smallpox case. They're not going to be fooled by that stuff. So what did they do instead? They said, well, let's go after the animals. And along comes bird flu.
I'm glad we're at bird flu now. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And what's happening with bird flu? Oh, well, guess what? We've got a PCR test and we can swab the cows and the chickens. And so they run around. It was joyfully swabbing healthy animals and saying, oops, we found a nucleotide sequence. Here it is. It's a deadly nucleotide sequence. Look over there. One person died in Mexico. You know, it's this ginning up fear process, which is now so transparent to everybody. And of course, what do? They find a whole lot of asymptomatic chickens. These chickens have bird flu, but they're not sick. But you know what? A percentage of chickens get sick and they could spread. Even the ones that are asymptomatic can spread. Everybody panic, kill all the chickens. And they're culling healthy chickens by the million all over the world.
It's a chicken genocide.
It's a chicken genocide. Gary Larson must be sort of, I think he's still alive and well, but he must be absolutely horrified by what's happening to the chickens.
Somebody told me in America once, if you want to destroy America, kill all the chickens.
Yeah.
Because literally millions of people would starve. It is the most affordable, nutritious protein available there.
I have direct personal experience of this. Let me give you an anecdote. I used to be on the board of the largest protein provider in South Africa. So their products were all based on the cheapest form of chicken meat, which is called mechanically deboned chicken meat. And it goes into products like Viennas and Polony and so on. And that company served up in South Africa a million servings of protein a day on average. So you can imagine that what they're doing is basically underpinning the soundness of the nutrition of the entire country. And that value chain is entirely based on chickens. Quite disturbingly, that company's sales showed a very pronounced drop-off intra-month. So when people get their paychecks for about the first week, a lot of them can afford protein. But as the month goes by and various accidents and incidents befall them and their incomes are whittled down, by the end of the month, the rate of protein consumption has dropped off. And as you point out, there are no massively available alternative sources of protein to mechanically deboned chicken meat. And yes, an interruption of that supply chain would have dire public health consequences, way exceeding anything that could potentially emerge from bird flu, which again looks like a completely drummed up construct.
Have you got any thoughts on people who resisted all of this? You talked about, the class stratas, let's say, there's you've explained that, and who sort of bought in, who didn't. But I didn't buy in, and many people I know, well, not too many actually, didn't buy in. And we're still scratching our heads when we talk about this to try and find the thing that in all of us was triggered to resist, and haven't quite got there yet. Everyone has a slightly different take, but came to the same place. Yeah, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts on that because my organization is stuffed to the rafters with people who not only didn't buy in, but who spoke out against. So I can talk to the characteristic of that subset of the people who didn't buy in. The first thing I would observe is that a very common characteristic is independence primarily financial independence. So people who have their own businesses or are somehow insulated from regulatory predation are more likely to speak out. And that's not too surprising. It just means that the negative consequences of speaking out are less profound for those people. But I can also talk about a characteristic which I would call mental independence, having an independent mind. This characteristic, I would note, is found more commonly in people who have traveled a lot, changed careers, people who have read a lot outside of their educational establishments. But most importantly, the biggest characteristic that is outrageously common amongst the people who saw through the scam is that they are very low consumers of mainstream media.
I knew you were going to say that.
It's obvious when you think about it, isn't it?
It is. Ding.
Yeah.
In fact, I'd like to make a comment about that. Starting to notice that people who are just starting to think about this now were so in a bubble, they didn't have any clue there was any other information or any other place to go. And of course, the whole conspiracy theory thing scared them off to the point where myself and others can't quite believe, what's the word? The willful blindness, I guess I'd call it.
Yeah. It's willful blindness, and amongst the people who have influential roles, a spectacular commitment to lying. Those are the two characteristics.
Well, there is that.
Spectacular commitment to lying, willful blindness. I wonder, though, whether what the COVID phenomenon didn't reveal is that it's always like that. That our society is almost structured, or they've evolved. And I mean, when I say evolved both in the cultural and social sense and in the genetic sense, to have a majority of people who are tend to be happy with the status quo, who go along to get along, who don't cause any trouble. And then a minority, the mavericks, who are the engines for change, the people who challenge the assertion of dominance and hierarchy, authority, the people who speak truth to power. I think that it has always been thus. And so it's not necessarily the case that we should be terribly surprised that there's a majority of people who were incredibly gullible and fell for the narrative of a novel deadly virus and the need for them to run around with their skirts above their heads and hide under their beds. That may be as old as humanity.
Yeah.
What we can look at, though, is what was done to influence that herd, to point that herd in a certain direction. And there, we, you know, this is not even a matter of conspiracy theory, because very little was done behind closed doors or in secret. Most of it was done very much in the public eye. The co-option of media has been a multi-decadal, maybe even multi-century story. And nowadays, global organizations have the power to grab the world's mainstream media by the throat and force them to march according to a certain tune.
What sort of resistance would make sense for the next time it happens? What can be done?
Look, reality is your friend, and knowledge is your friend, and knowledge is not obtained from authority figures. This is an incredible mistake that people make. You know, this whole idea of that there's something wrong with doing your own research is nothing could be further from the truth. Governments are systematic liars. Politicians are systematic liars. Their media representatives are systematic liars. Now, this should all be obvious to every kind of, you know, vaguely critical thinking person. So you don't get your knowledge from mainstream media. That's a ridiculous idea. I'm not saying that every single article in every single media outlet is false. No, but the ones about important events are all false. They're all driving you towards a certain political perception or outcome. So you do need to look, you do need to do your own research. And I'm not talking about everybody needing to do the kind of elaborate statistical and data science work that we did. Just look around you. Do you observe people falling down in the manner depicted by the famous falling down Chinese man videos. No, you don't. You haven't seen that once. Do you know of a 40-year-old friend who complained about a cough, got worse and worse, and actually had to go and check himself into hospital and died? No, you don't. You know, this was not what was observed. When you got sick, was it really that different from the last flu that you had? It's just, there's so many things that to look around made it obvious that we were dealing with a scam. One of the things I did was, because I run my own business, I declared myself an essential worker. I was the CEO, and under the laws of the country, I had that power. So I declared myself an essential worker and drove around to see what was actually happening in the world under the conditions of lockdown. And of course, I visited the black townships where the sort of lower income groups reside in South Africa. And what I found there was that they, of course, had to just carry on with their daily hustle. And they weren't wearing masks and they weren't social distancing. And they weren't dying like flies. So,
it's pretty obvious.
It was quite clear that the whole lockdown that the white suburbs were observing with great religiosity were actually just futile performative gestures.
Speaking of religiosity, there was a lot of follow the science. And I've heard this word scientism. And I was wondering, and others have wondered this too, if that was kind of took on a religious dimension, to believe in, that you could feel very secure in saying follow the science, even though a lot of people were saying that without even understanding what the fundamental concept of science is, and that is it's a method, it's a process for finding things out. And that seemed to be, for many people, my observation anyway, seemed to bring a lot of security to people. They could say follow the science, it's the science, scientism, like a worshipping of science.
So I talk about the great hubris, and it's a construct that refers to the tendency of midwit people to vastly underestimate the consequences of complexity, whether we're dealing with economies or society or the human body, the human immune system, the climate, ecologies. We are talking about complex systems, and there's a kind of irreducibility to complexity that leaves us with the cold hard reality that analytical methods are useless in approaching the evolution and direction of complex systems. We can't adopt a command and control approach to the economy without doing damage. This has been proven in every communist state that ever there was. We can't micromanage the human immune system by way of sticking liquids into needles and plunging them into people's shoulders. We can't manage society on an ethical and moral basis by doing a calculation in a spreadsheet, coming up with some kind of utilitarian construct. The recognition that we can't do those things is, I believe, the greatest indication of a person's intelligence that there is. IQ tests, university degrees, years in school don't count at all. If you believe that we are able to command complexity, then you're a fool. Yet that is the great hubris that underpins so many of the phenomena that we see in our modern society. It's not merely the idea of how we should respond to pandemics or control people's immune systems with needles. It's also the idea that we should centralize things on a global scale, pandemic response, climate response. It's the idea that we can control the climate. It's the idea that we can predict what it is that affects the climate and what the effects on the climate will actually do to the flourishing or otherwise of human beings. All of these are common bedfellows. They're perspectives on reality that share this attribute of a failure to recognize the consequences of complexity and also the futility of centralized response. It's not just the futility, the necessary and predictable damages that stem from a centralized response to any complex phenomenon. And to me, this is the greatest insight that I would like to share with other human beings. If I could wave a wand and change one thing about people's perceptions, it would be to engineer recognition that the great hubris is the notion that human beings can control centrally complex systems.
Yeah, well put. Nick, before you go, if you were to come back, which I think you will come back, because it's so interesting talking with you, what else would you like to talk about?
There is a strand of work that I've been heavily engaged with for a long time. The subject area is one that may not be very familiar to your listeners, called epistemology. It's the theory of knowledge. It addresses the question of how we create new knowledge in the face of complexity, what are the ways in which knowledge forms, and so on. And it's yielded for me a number of insights into what the common feature is of the various crises that we are confronted with. Now, people say that we face a threat from the emergence of AI. Some of them even believe that there's a singularity ahead of us in which the computers suddenly outpace humans as the most intelligent entities in the universe, with dire consequences for the human race. There's, of course, the climate change crisis. Then there's the purported future of transhumanism, which is going to be a crisis because it'll create a small elite of Ubermensch, of Superman, and a great feudal mass of serfs who are not beneficiaries of the remarkable transhumanist technology. It manifests in life extension crises where the idea is that there will be a whole bunch of people out there who have, you know, normal to poor lifespans, and then a bunch of exalted beings who overcome mortality in its entirety. There are all sorts of ideas that have a common element to their particular lunacy. And I've been developing a conversation that tries to tease out those common elements and create a discussion around what we can do about them.
It's been really interesting chatting with you, Nick Hudson, Panda Chairman. Thank you for making some time for us. And let's see what our audience make of that. I expect we'll get emails and texts following that. Yeah.
Real pleasure chatting. I would steer your audience members towards our website, pandata.org, and the Substack site is pandauncut.substack.com. I'm also on Twitter on the handle Nick Hudson CT, N-I-C-K Hudson CT. People can follow me there.
Maybe we'll chat again. Thanks again so much.
That would be a lot of fun. Thanks very much, and go well.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.